Greetings, everyone. Some additional news to share with you. Just heard today, Mr. E.B. Vance had called my wife, and then Glenda went by to see the building that a young man who had been for many, many years in the Worldwide Church owns. It is down in the central part of Tyler, not too far from the women's building in the older part of town. It's an older building. I think you said about 3,000 or more square feet. Three restrooms, a fairly large room that used to be apparently be a display room for like a clothing place of some kind. It does have some posts and pillars in it, but it might make an adequate place for a meeting room. And we will be looking at it, and it might be a possibility that in the next 2 to 3 months or so, we'll be making a transition from the present offices, if this works out and if the price is right. It'll be larger by a good bit than where we are. And we've already outgrown where we are. We knew it was a temporary little place, and there's virtually, well, there's no storage space at all. And by the time we're on Springfield, we'll have to have at least 5 people manning the telephones, and I hope later on more. We have 2 more telephones coming in on Wednesday. We already have 3 lines in there, 4 actually, when you count the facts. So that'll give us 5 open telephone lines for the people that will be calling in for literature when they first see the telecast. We did another television program yesterday in my study out of the house, moved the furniture around again, and did one more. And so usually the people, I believe, who will see this sermon along the way, and there are, I think, 113 of these tapes being mailed out, if I'm accurate on that.
It's growing.
It's growing, and more are coming
along. Close to 130 now.
Up to 130. So there will be 130 groups, some of them fairly good-sized congregations. Others will be smaller, hosted fellowship groups, just some families meeting together that will see this sermon. And God bless all of you. We love you. Thank you for your letters, your support, your phone calls, your prayers, the people that will be seeing this, and some of them all over the world. I want to tell those, if some of you are getting this overseas, especially in Australia, people sent me some cash, not much, but a little bit, and I didn't know exactly what 150 or so kroner were worth from Norway, but they also sent some Australian money, and I went down to the bank, and they returned that money to me in a little envelope, and it was worth 10 cents on the dollar, but they charge a $20 fee just to exchange it. And so I'm trying now to find out who sent me. If any of you are seeing this videotape and you're the gentleman who sent me money from Norway, give me your name and address and let me send it back to you. And those who don't send cash, whatever you do, I don't think that that's too safe to send cash in the mails anyway. But I was really alarmed when I found out what the exchange rate was for some of that. So that was just another interesting thing as an aside, but we certainly appreciate the people wanting to help. That's the main thing. We know we are living in very, very dangerous times. I think all of you are very up to date on what is happening. Let me bring up today as of an hour ago. I found out from CNN just before coming here that the 2 men who were arrested in Las Vegas the other day were not carrying lethal anthrax, but were carrying an anthrax culture, which was apparently used as an inoculation. Apparently, both of them are microbiologists, even though they are a couple of the scruffiest-looking characters you ever saw if you saw them on television. And they are members of the so-called Aryan Nation, which is a ultra-right wing, Hitlerian, Nazi kind of an anti-Jewish, anti-black, anti-foreigner, ultra-right wing white supremacist organization. These men were arrested before carrying a vial of bubonic plague culture, and with a map of the New York subway system in their possession. They were actually interviewed, and I have seen some of the portions of an interview with the leader of this little fledgling group. They are quite capable of carrying out the same kind of terrorist acts that occurred over in Tokyo and in other cities, I think in Nagoya, Yokohama, in Japan, when they unleashed deadly sarin nerve gas in crowded subways, and many, many people died. I want to just give you what the top of the news is right quick, because it has to do with some of the prophecies in the Bible, and I think we'll look through some of those, go through them with a fine-tooth comb, and see whether or not some of the things that are about to be unleashed upon this world and are being threatened by Saddam Hussein and by some of the Iraqis in this country are, in fact, covered in the Bible. Israel is reported ready to use a neutron bomb on Iraq. I got this off the internet this morning. I interrogated the internet. I've been looking up things like anthrax and VX. This was under the nuclear category, but also looking at some of the other deadly biological and chemical weapons that are in the arsenal of Saddam Hussein, such things as phosgene, as mustard gas, and they've already used things like that against their own citizens, as you know, the Kurds, and used them against Iranian villages during the eight-year war between Iraq and Iran. From combined dispatches, Israel has reached agreement with the United States to explode a neutron nuclear bomb in an Iraqi city in the event of a serious attack by Saddam Hussein, according to a report in the Australian newspaper The Age and the British military publisher's Jane's Information. Jane's ships and Jane's books, they publish books on the most up-to-date, sophisticated weaponry of all the arsenals of the world, and they're an extremely prestigious publication. So that's not just some little fly-by-night National Enquirer. When Jane's says that the Israelis are saying that they've already worked out a deal with the United States that they would drop a neutron bomb. Now, a neutron bomb is a nuclear weapon which emits deadly rays, but it does not leave residual radioactivity. It leaves the buildings standing. It is a nuclear flash unleashed in the air, and it wipes out everybody that those rays reach. It kills them dead, just like flies, but it leaves the buildings intact and it does not contaminate the area. Also, there is something here that I want to read to you that Yoav Lemmer from Jerusalem said, quote, "This time Israel will not simply sit back and watch." Remember I told you before about the Israeli general that used the analogy of dying Samson, who, when he was blinded, pulled the portals of that building down, and all the hundreds that were on the balcony fell down and were crushed to their death. And it said that thus he killed more people in his death than he did during his life, when he slew so many of them with the jawbone of an ass. And so this Israeli general told an American general, before we Jews will ever again be led away to the gas chamber, we will pull down the temple of humanity. Now, when you've got a nation with its back to the wall, citizens are fleeing Israel. Did you see that report? Israelis coming to the United States because they're just as scared, they don't want to stay there. And one of them that I saw interviewed is running for the mayor of a small Israeli town. And he is in Miami right now because he was so afraid to stay there. When you've got people that can't get there, they're 5 hours standing in line. How would you like to stand in line for 5 hours at a national distribution center to get yourself a gas mask and to find out by the time you got to the head of the line they were out? How would you feel about it if you lived in a society where that is imminent? Now, we know that Cozy Annan is over there right now as we speak and has been having meetings with the Israeli government, with the Iraqi government. And I don't know to what effect, whether or not he's going to be successful or not. And I think you've all heard it, so you know that they're trying to propose that a couple of diplomats or so from different nations would accompany the UN investigators as they go into the various presidential palaces, but only a window of about 2 months, and then they're going to close them down and you can't get there anymore. Well, obviously, this insane idiot, Saddam Hussein, has got plenty that he wants to hide. And everybody knows that he does possess those weapons, and he possesses the infrastructure to make more. This was just in this morning in what I got off of the internet, an 8-page report in the, it doesn't identify the magazine here, a December issue of the magazine detailed how close Iraqi President Saddam Hussein came to building a bomb before the 1991 Gulf War. The scientific and industrial infrastructure to build a bomb are in place, and hundreds of employees of the nuclear establishment remain on permanent standby, supported by the government, so said the magazine, that for some reason is unnamed. This gives you an idea of the climate in Israel today. Tel Aviv, Israel, as of the 20th, day before yesterday, or yesterday, wasn't it? Dancing their fears of Saddam Hussein away, hundreds of Israelis crowded a Tel Aviv nightclub today for an anthrax party, partying in gas masks while a siren wailed and a mock Scud missile hovered overhead. Worrying won't help, declared Sima Levi, 23. We might as well have a good time. It was a rare moment of levity for an increasingly tense Israel, which has been braced for a feared retaliatory attack by Iraq in the UN. In the UN weapons inspection standoff, beg your pardon. For weeks, Israelis have been standing in long lines to get gas masks and stocking up on plastic sheeting and tape to create a home bunker in case of Iraqi attack with biological or chemical weapons. But a Tel Aviv's KU club, they mocked the fears that haunted them. At one point, dancers ripped off their gas masks and sank to the dance floor, acting out a slow death as a siren sounded. So that reminds me of the people who died in the wake of a hurricane that hit the Texas Gulf Coast one time many years ago, and they were found even lying under mattresses, and they had this giant orgy of a party, calling it a hurricane party. They were going to stay there and just party out the night. Well, it didn't work. The hurricane killed them all. But sometimes human beings act that way. Toward the end of it, one man said, leaning on the bar, nobody took the threat seriously until the Scuds started flying back in the Gulf War. We're laughing at it now, but when I'm sober tomorrow, I'm sure the situation will be far more worrying. I got an article, that article that I read you from Chris Cumming this morning on the internet about the Israelis dancing their fears away came in from email by Chris Cumming just this morning. I now have email and the internet access at home, and I will go in and log on. It will say out loud, "You have mail," and I will punch it, and there Chris Cumming has sent me some mail. So things are happening, and as we well know, tomorrow, the next day, the day after, between now and the next time we meet together, could see the bombs flying over in Iraq, and then we'll never know what Iraq will do in retaliation. But the thing that I'm more concerned about, and want to at least address, and I say again, I am not Chicken Little. This is not to instill fear in the minds of any of us. We know where we are, and we know where we stand with God. We know where our faith and where our trust is, and we're not the kind of people that are going to fear, because God's Word says that we should not fear as do others who have no hope. And as I will show you toward the end today, there is no reason for you or I, as God's children and God's people, whose lives are hid with Christ in God, and our lives are secure for God's kingdom, to fear what man can do unto us. But certainly having a healthy regard for what might happen in this country, and to qualify as those who are described in Ezekiel 9 as those who sigh and cry for the horrible abominations that are done all around them, if we have any empathy for our own people, and if I focus in on my grandchildren who are here today, and other people's children, the children of people that I love, and loved ones, and other people scattered around the United States, I think of the huge teeming metropolis that is Phoenix, Arizona, and my remaining sibling who was alive of the four of us, Beverly and Dick being gone, but my sister Dottie and my brother-in-law Vern, that I love so deeply, are over there in a very populated, densely populated area. Now I think of David and Molly and the brethren in the church out in L.A. And they're being lashed with one storm after another of this El Nino effect. Now what is chilling is that we've been hearing lately that the Iraqis are bragging that they have got students that are in major universities all over the United States, that they have people scattered around this country who could act as terrorists and they could unleash some of these deadly agents in populated areas. They can take a little vial the size of your thumb and take like a Cessna 172 light single-engine aircraft and get it up about 5,000 feet depending upon where the winds are, and simply sprinkle it into the air, and those spores would settle over a huge swath of an area of a huge city, and literally tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people could die. You know how you know when you've got anthrax? You start to cough, you have a fever, you get a headache, and the symptoms are exactly like the flu. But the doctors don't know you've got anthrax, and you don't know you've got anthrax because it would just settle like a little unfelt thing, like a yeast spore that is in the air. But within 3 to 5 days, at the most a week, your lungs fill completely up with fluid, and you die. And it's a horrifying death, and it is flu-like symptoms. And that's only one, this VX nerve gas that he's got. And he's got, apparently, thousands of gallons of it, according to the UN officials. Is so deadly that one little drop on the back of your hand will kill you. Now, can you imagine a rotten, filthy human being who is deliberately stockpiling those kinds of weapons, and he's not stockpiling them to use them just as a threat, he's stockpiling them because he intends to use them. Look up in your encyclopedias Saladin, S-A-L-A-D-I-N. Maybe I can give you something on that at some point in time. But Saladin was a great Arab leader who united a lot of the Arabs and actually overran Egypt and ran a lot of the Christians out of there. And he was a great Islamic leader who was sort of like a king of the south among the Arabs. Now, this egocentric, his ego is unbounded, his vanity is unlimited, his egocentricity is absolutely swollen with totish vanity, this Saddam Hussein, imagines himself as another Nebuchadnezzar. If you study any Arab history, you know that some of the great nations of all of history were in the Near and the Middle East. Civilization began with Nimrod and with Akkad and Calneh and with Babylon. And of course, one of the greatest leaders of Babylon of all time was Nebuchadnezzar. He was depicted in the second chapter of Daniel as the head of gold. And maybe sometime you ought to pick up Halley's Bible Handbook and simply look up Babylon and read the little article about the city of Babylon, about those incredible walls that were so wide and so high, about 100 feet high, and then another wall way inside of that one, and they were wide enough for actually like 6-horse chariots to make a turn in the corner and gallop back and forth around them to take men with their bows and arrows and their spears and their boiling oil or whatever to some kind of a trouble spot. And it was a fabulous, fabulous city. This madman wants to go down in history as the leader of an Islamic state that had exterminated the Jews. He wants to carve out for himself a place in history as the great Arab leader of a modern time that is as great as Nebuchadnezzar was anciently, or a Saladin or someone. He is utterly heartless and cruel. He has no conscience at all. The idea of the suffering of women or little babies as a result of what he might unleash in an attack on other nations or his own people does not move him at all. He is utterly without a conscience. Now, if you will turn to Matthew 24, we're familiar with this prophecy. I'm only going to be there for a moment. But shockingly, we tend to look at the building of the temple there. We tend to look at what Christ says, the two things for which we are to watch, is first of all, an abomination of desolation standing in a holy place where it ought not, verse 15. And in Luke 21 and verses 19 through 21, he talks about when you shall see Jerusalem surrounded with armies. Well, we know that the abomination of desolation is the great false prophet that I believe is a living head at that time. I don't know whether he's the current one or his successor, who is going to be the head of the Roman Catholic Church, who will actually inject himself into the strife in the Middle East and will enter into a temple of God. Now, for years we've speculated what would cause a temple to be built. I got another article on the internet just the other day from Mr. Chris Cumming. An Australian, I believe, maybe Austrian, I've forgotten, archaeologist, who has been investigating the subterranean areas beneath the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock, has discovered that there are gargantuan ancient cisterns, some of them as big as a huge, big city water tank, that are deep beneath the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock. He claims that the cracks that are visible here and there in the walls and the structures are as a result of the settling over the many, many years of the stone above, and is warning that this is a great tragedy or disaster waiting to happen. The people that are there on the site ridicule that and don't agree with it. But if something like that from a natural phenomenon, for example, there was an earthquake to which they attribute the cracks that are visible in the walls there back in 1927, 3 years before I was born. And the people that disagree with this archaeologist's warning, a very recent date, state that no, those cracks are as a result of that earthquake. But earthquakes had struck in that area. The point is that if anything caused those mosques to simply collapse into rubble, who would the Arabs blame? They would say sabotage, and they would blame the Jews, even if it were triggered by an earthquake, because they would say, remember what they did when the tunnel was opened up? And actually, the tunnel was already about two-thirds or three-fourths open. It was a tunnel, but the end of it was filled with rubble. And when they opened it up as a tourist attraction, it actually caused the tourists to devolve on the streets of the old city of Jerusalem, though it was entered right along the Wailing Wall. And they could walk beneath the streets of the city and come up into the old city in this tunnel. The Arabs began accusing the Jews, specifically the government of Benjamin Netanyahu, of deliberately undermining the foundations of those mosques. Now you have to figure this too. This takes an engineer. But when you have Ramadan, or some so-called holy occasion, and that big, huge, big open pavement area of stones, I've been on it many a time. I've been in the Dome of the Rock. My wife and I have been there. You take your shoes off and you put on slippers and you go through, and the Vances have been there and been in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But when they crowd that place, there can be a couple of 100,000 human beings on the average weighing 160, 80 pounds standing up there on that area, and beneath it, it is completely hollow. As a matter of fact, in one corner, you go down underneath there, and that's where Solomon's stables are, on the one corner that overlooks the Brook Kidron. So the engineers are worried about the time might come when there would be throngs of 100,000 or so Arabs that would be jamming that square, and what if it just collapses under them? Well, who would get the blame? The Jews. And then, of course, there's no telling what would happen. The point is that what Jesus said here in the very first part of this prophecy, the time is going to come, verse 2, when there will not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. Now, that is literal, isn't it? But I have been there, Mr. and Mrs. Vance have been there, maybe some of you have been there, and that western wall that is visible actually contains the very stones that Jesus and the disciples saw. Of course, the temple was intact above it, but there are many of those stones, and some of them are the size of about half of that wall, just gigantic slabs of limestone. And they are fit together so perfectly that when they took the rubble of the detritus of decades and centuries away and dug down to the bedrock of where the original stones were, which now forms the Wailing Wall that is so important to the Jews, you can see that here are many of those stones resting conformably atop the other. And this prophecy only took place in type when the stones above that part of the wall were prized loose by the armies of Titus, and when the buildings of the temple were completely destroyed and the area was leveled. It is going to happen again. So no matter what we think, the prophecy of Matthew 24 is dual, and a prophecy of Jesus Christ that depicts massive destruction of Jerusalem and therefore terrible loss of life. The only way I can see that the Jews would give in to the strident voices of ultra-right-wing religious organizations, and where the government itself would get behind it and give the money so that they would build a temple, is by some massive loss of life among the Israeli population, which would cause the nation as a whole to simply jump into the arms of the ultra-religious leadership and say, we're going to turn to God, to the God that the Jews believe they worship, and we're going to do as in the days of Josiah. We're going to have a great restoration. We're going to restore the priests. We're going to restore the sacrifices. We're going to keep a great Passover. We're going to slay the red heifer. We're going to have the priests there in their garbs. We're going to turn to God because half of our population has been wiped out. If that were to happen, and hundreds of thousands of Jews were to die, then it doesn't matter anymore. Forget politics. Forget diplomacy. The bulldozers would go rumbling toward those mosques and they would level them, and a temple would be built. Then it would take some time for the Arab nations around to all get together. Now they fight and they war among themselves, but eventually they would get together in an event like that from all the way from Tunisia and Morocco and all the way down to Sidi Ifni, and clear the Sinaitic Peninsula. Libya would get into the act, and Egypt, and all the rest of them would unitedly try to annihilate the Jews. Then Europe would have to intervene. I was thinking just this morning, what a coup it would be, not if Annan of the United Nations, the Secretary General, and what a farce, would go there and talk to the leadership of Iraq. But what if the Pope went down there? But you see, he won't do that because that is an Islamic area, and the big problems down there are between Islamic people and the Jews. Not necessarily Christians, even though, of course, all those people call us the great Satan and hate us very, very much. So as I think about these things, I'm merely trying to wonder, in the light of present-day events and trends and conditions, how will the prophecies eventually come to pass? In the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, that is covered. I won't take a lot of time with that because I have other things I want to cover right quickly, and I may run out of time. But let's skim through that, because in verse 40, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him the king of the north. The king of the north, in this prophecy, the lengthiest prophecy in all the Bible, is Antiochus Epiphanes, and when he is introduced in verses 21 and 2, and I believe that there is a shadowy type of the Kaiser, who was a raiser of taxes, the original man in history was named Heliodorus, and then Adolf Hitler, the vile person who would stand up in his estate, to whom they would not give the honor of the kingdom, to come in during a time of peace and obtain the kingdom by flatteries, verse 21. The point I want to make is that that seems to be a shadowy type of the Kaiser succeeded by Adolf Hitler, and once that individual, historically, Antiochus Epiphanes, prophetically in type Adolf Hitler, but prophetically in the future, the king of the north, who is the beast power, once Antiochus Epiphanes was introduced in this prophecy that was given to Daniel, that individual never again changes. He is never superseded or succeeded by any other individual. The prophecy continues right to the time of the intervention of Almighty God, leaving Antiochus Epiphanes as the one who was identified, and it was also called the vile person who came in following the demise of a tax collector. And Hohenzollern means tax collector. And there were shadowy types there, the Kaiser Wilhelm and Adolf Hitler. At the time of the end shall the king of the south. Who is that? Well, eventually, it was a lesser line of pharaohs in Egypt called the Ptolemies, and it was an Egyptian. Will it be again? Or will it be a Saddam Hussein? Or will it be a leader of a Saudi Arabian nation? I just don't know. And I think we will know when we see who is it who emerges as such a powerful Arab leader that all the other Arab states begin to follow his will and to agree to his policies, and that is the new coalition down there. Not a weak coalition that fell apart and is not supporting the United States at all right now today, including Egypt that has backed away from us. Saudi Arabia has backed away. They won't allow our aircraft to fly from their bases, even though we built the bases with our money. Turkey won't allow us to fly from their bases, and we've been protecting them for years. But there is no real support in the Gulf except behind the scenes implicit support from the United Arab Emirates and from Abu Dhabi and from Bahrain, but nothing else really. Well, from Kuwait, of course, because Kuwait is basically held hostage by the United States because of their debt to us from the Gulf War. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. And I've always thought an oil embargo would do that, because Europe depends up to 46% for its energy supplies from the Gulf. Japan about 70%, the United States about 17%. And if they were to clamp down oil and it were no longer to flow to fuel the industry of the developed nations of Central Europe, they would have to react immediately. There wouldn't be very much time to waste. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. What would cause a united coalition of a European army to come right down into the Gulf? Right now we're sending little bits and dribs of American soldiers, a few hundred here, a few hundred there. We only have a number of thousands over there. We've got about 10,000 people on two aircraft carriers and in 20 ships all together in the two battle groups in the Gulf. But there are not a lot of land forces, just a very few thousand, nowhere near as many as Saddam Hussein has, even in his Republican Guard. But during the Gulf War, we had over 500,000 men and women down there. Now, we have only a fraction of that number today. But this is talking about a massive invasion. When it says, like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, and ships, it is, of course, talking about aircraft and tanks and ships of today. And he shall enter the countries and shall overflow and pass over. So it is a very many countries are involved, not just one country. Enter into the countries and overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, Palestine, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, or Ammon, and that's the capital of Jordan. Edom is Turkey. Moab may be some of the people in western Iraq, or the Lebanese, or other Hashemite Arabs. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And while he is there, then, it says, tidings, verse 44, out of the east and out of the north trouble him, and that shapes up for the Battle of Armageddon, where literally 200 million human beings come swarming in there, probably from China and from Russia and from all of Gog and Magog, identified in the biblical prophecies as Rosh. There are the Russians and the people east and north of Palestine.
Let's turn back to the book of Revelation, to the 8th chapter, because I haven't covered this in many, many years, but that I think about what John saw.
And that's what he wrote. He only wrote what he saw. And then I think of what would be my impression if I had lived during the days of John, and I had never remotely even heard an engine of any kind, not a motorcycle or a sewing machine. And I knew nothing about any modern inventions, and any kind of conveyance that I knew would be pulled by a donkey, or I would ride on a horse or a camel or a donkey or something like that. But what if in his mind's eye he saw a couple or three swarms, 6 or 8 or 10 Apache helicopters that were suddenly just looming above the horizon with these big rocket pods, and they can fire both ways, from the rear or the front. And they have these huge big shields there. Here are these men in there with these big bulbous turrets of guns that can actually be directed by the man just looking. You know that that's the way they work? They have what's called a heads-up display. It's electronically connected to the man's visor on his helmet. He's looking right here at a target, and he just looks at the target, and the gun swivels over there, and it's a Gatling gun that spews out thousands of 20-millimeter rounds a minute and just devastates anything in its path. Now, what if a man living in the first century had been projected forward in his mind's eye, like in a Technicolor movie, a high-tech movie with the special effects that they have so many of them today, and he saw these things? Let's look what he said that he saw. When he opened the seventh seal, remember the book of Revelation divided into seven seals. The first six seals end up in the tribulation, which is the military part of the fifth seal. The sixth seal is the heavenly sign that stops all human activity. The seventh seal is divided into seven trumpet plagues, the last three of which are called woe, woe, woe. The third woe is divided into seven last plagues. So there are three divisions of seven. Seven seals, seven trumpet plagues, the seventh of which is the third woe, and divided into seven last plagues. Here are the trumpet plagues that he saw. When he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and them were given seven trumpets. And another angel come and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of saints before the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense, which is a type of the prayers of God's people, brokenheartedly, praying because of the death and the maiming and the anguish and the destruction that is happening all around them, and praying not only for themselves, but for their loved ones, for their country, for their people, intercessory prayers. It is depicted as sweet-smelling incense that is smoking and comes up before the very throne of God. And the angel took the censer where the incense is collected, and then he filled it with the fire of the altar, which is like filling it with the wrath of God. And he cast it under the earth, which is God's answer eventually to all those prayers that are ascending up for God's mercy and his protection upon his people and vengeance. He says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." But vengeance on brutal, rotten, genocidal maniacs like Saddam Hussein, who threatens the peace of the whole world. If I were living right now in Ohio, and I were like in the vicinity of Ohio State campus, if I were living in a great big teeming city like New York, and I had to get on a subway, I would begin to be a little bit nervous about the people around me. And if I saw a swarthy, dark-skinned person wearing a turban or looked like a Middle Eastern Arab, I'd be a little nervous about it, too. Because that's what Saddam Hussein and his ilk and the Iranians and this Hamas and some of these very virulent extremist organizations, there are many, many of them, of the Arabs, are actually threatening in the United States to carry out terrorist attacks. They did it in the New York Trade Center, didn't they? And the, now we've got domestic terrorists, the two arrested in Las Vegas, and of course the guys that bombed the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. So that's real. It is not just something you look in the news that happened somewhere else. That's very real. And there were people that died in the trade towers, and people came out of there with just black soot and were crying, and people that were injured. And these rotten so-and-sos were trying to bring those buildings down. They were trying to destroy that gargantuan, huge building with thousands and thousands of people in it. They failed in doing that, but they did carry out a vicious terrorist attack. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. And the first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth, and the third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. Is this literal or is it metaphorical? It seems to deal in thirds time and again, a third of the sun, a third part of the day, and so on. And it also says in the book of Ezekiel that a third part of the peoples of the 10 tribes of Israel will be dead as a result of disease, pestilence, starvation, attacks by wild animals. A third of them then will be survivors, but up to two-thirds of them will be killed because another third will be killed in the initial invasion and as a result of armed forces, and a remaining third are to be scattered into all the winds all over the world, and of them apparently only eventually 10% of the populations of all those countries will remain alive by the time of the second coming of Jesus Christ. We have, what, 260-some million people in the United States? There will be 26 million Americans remaining. By the time the millennium begins, there will be 26 million Americans resettled on these lands in the beginning of the millennial reign of Jesus Christ. That's all there will be. Far less than a population of Texas, to be sprinkled all the way from New England down to California. That's what God's Word says is coming on our peoples. The second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea. I take that it looks like either a literal meteor that comes hurling down and smashes into the oceans, or else again it is metaphor, and it is an angelic messenger that carries out a plague by divine fiat. And a third part of the sea became blood. And a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third part of the ships were destroyed. I won't go through all of those, but look at verse 11. There was a star that fell like a burning lamp and came down into the wild waters, this time the creeks and the rivers and the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, a very poisonous kind of bitter, acrid taste. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. In chapter 9, he says, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. Now that's what he saw. He saw a brilliant star, like a meteor, falling, and he wrote what he saw. And to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. So obviously the star is an angel. Revelation 1:10 shows that the stars are symbols of angels. And he opened the bottomless pit, the traditional mythological Pandora's box. The lid is off of Pandora's box, and out comes all these hideous creatures. Again, symbol or metaphor. And there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth. If I had been flying over Kuwait in the Gulf War, and I had seen hundreds and hundreds of oil wells burning, and the landscape for hundreds of miles just solid, choking, roiling, blowing clouds of black soot as far as you could see. And then I saw a whole squadron of helicopters emerging out of that with laser-guided bombs and rockets blazing from beneath them and smashing into targets. But I were a citizen of the first century, how would I write that? How would I describe it? How would I put into words to try to tell anyone what I was seeing in my vision? I think that maybe some of the things that exist right now today are what John saw in his mind's eye in those visions that God gave him. locusts upon the earth. And doesn't a great big attack helicopter look just like a locust? They've got that great big forward part with the funny looking dome on it and that big bulbous chin with the cannon there. And they've got the whirring wings. They've got the long tail with another whirring propeller back there. They've got the possibility to shoot back as well as forward. And he describes this, and I think that may be what he saw. He says, there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. And it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth. Now, I just mentioned a moment ago a neutron bomb. They have now invented, as you know, a neutron bomb that will kill people, but it does not annihilate the landscape. It doesn't burn up the trees, doesn't destroy the buildings, just deadly rays like gamma rays that reach human flesh and brain and kill them. They drop dead on the spot, but it does not destroy the buildings. Neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. Remember Ezekiel 9 and the writer's ink horn. He says, begin the slaying. And again, there again, it was metaphorical. And he said, hurt not any man upon whom is the seal of God. And who are they? They are those who are converted, those who are repentant, those who want to do God's will and live according to God's way, those who have the Holy Spirit of God in their minds and hearts, and those who will not, even if it costs them their life, give in to the mark of the beast, the image of the beast, or the number of his name. They will not worship on Sunday. They will not worship the sign of the cross. They will not worship the Roman Catholic doctrine handed down to the Protestant churches of this world. They will not get into sun worship and idolatry. They will worship the true God and Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and they will know when it's all over that they have had to fight the beast and his image and the number of his name. Because this entire Sunday-keeping Western society of ours is geared to exactly that kind of paganism. I've had to write letters just recently, a couple, three, four letters I'm having to work on for people that want to have their children hand in a slip to a vice principal that my child can be off on this or that day because it's a holy day of our church. Had to write a letter and sign it just the other day for people that want a letter to take to their employer to ask if they can get off on the Sabbath day. Have to write a form letter to people that talk about the Feast of Tabernacles so they can get off from their job or get their children out of school. And they are hassled and they are threatened and sometimes they lose their jobs and children are persecuted in school because of that. You begin to know when you obey God and observe His Sabbath day, you begin to know that you're running afoul of a Sunday-keeping, idolatrous world that is patterned according to the Roman Catholic Church and all of her protesting daughters that came out of her, but still really adhere to the same doctrines and the same religion. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, and this is something that I don't know whether it is some kind of a chemical that causes things like boils and carbuncles or a stinging, burning sensation, but it is described as something that torments someone for 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion, so it burns and stings just like a terrible bite of a stinging insect, and it lasts in agony and pain for 5 months. And look, in those days shall men seek death. So it is so painful that they really want to die, but apparently don't have the willpower to commit suicide, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle. Now during his day, when you prepared a horse unto battle, you put metal on its head. And you put metal and chain mail and so on over its forequarters. And then the man that rode might have a helmet and might have greaves on his legs and a big brass shield and a sword, and he was armored. And so John wrote in the language that was the best he could use with his limited understanding of what it was he was seeing. But what did God show him? What did he really see in his mind's eye? But maybe some of the very weapons of the day in which we live today that we are seeing every single day taking off of those ships out there, and pictures of helicopter gunships and F-18s and stealth bombers and fighters and things like that. And it says, like horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. That's because he may have seen pilots in there through the glass, that he might have seen a pilot in a helicopter. They had hair as the hair of women. Make me wonder about some of these helmets where these guys have long hair, but I don't think they allow that in the military, so I'm not quite sure what that is. Their teeth were as the teeth of lions. I don't know, maybe he saw the flashing of guns or something in his vision. They had breastplates, as it were, breastplates of iron, and you think of the great armored helicopters and the way they appear when you see them on television. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle, like a thunder or a roar of thousands of hoofs on a hard-packed landscape. So that would tell me that he's hearing the thunder of engines and he doesn't know how to describe it. He's trying to describe it as best he possibly can. And they had tails like unto scorpions. And there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And it shows that Satan the devil is behind it, that Satan the devil is going to be dancing a jig and rejoicing when he is watching human beings being annihilated because he wants the death of all of mankind. And Satan and his demons rejoice when massive numbers of human beings are killed. They had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, and in the Greek name, his name, Apollyon. One woe is past, and behold, there come two more woes hereafter. I won't read all of that, but it leads up to the great battle of Armageddon. In verse 17, it again describes these machines of some kind that are like horses with breastplates of fire and heads as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. I want to go now back to the book of Psalms. And take you, first of all, I've mentioned Ezekiel, the 9th chapter, about the writer's inkhorn and those who are protected. I won't turn to that and read it. But let's turn to Psalm 91. This is a very beautiful psalm of God's Word and very, very comforting. Psalm 91. Especially in the day and age in which we live, and for those that live in large cities that might be concerned about some of these overseas terrorists that are actually among us. When you think of someone that could carry a little vial about that big in his hand that could actually just rent a light plane and sprinkle it over a city. Chapter 91, verse 1. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Eternal, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God. In Him will I trust. Surely He shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence, and that's talking about a horrible disease, an ugly, awful disease. He shall cover thee with his feathers, just like you've seen a mother chick gather her little chickens under her wings, or like a quail or a pheasant will do. And under his wings shall you trust. His truth shall be your shield and your buckler. You shall not be afraid for the terror by night. Thank God we live in the United States of America. And thank God we live in a semi-rural area, most of us. We live in a fairly rural area, about 17 miles outside of Tyler. I thank God for that, because we don't live in a densely populated area where terrorists might attack here. But it doesn't mean they can't. But if you lived in Israel, and you had waited 4 or 5 hours the other day in line, only to get there and find out there are no more gas masks, you would know. If you were taping right now every little crack with plastic and tape in your house to seal off one or two rooms that you could go in there, then shut the door, and then tape it real quick, and all you can get is the air that is in there. I don't know how they can survive unless they've got oxygen. But to turn your home into a bunker against a chemical or a biological agent, and you thought it could come raining out of the skies at any moment. You can see where the Israelis have got mixed emotions about whether the United States ought to attack Iraq. Because the Iraqis can't reach the United States. They don't have missiles that will reach that far yet. They're working on it. They'd like to be able to. But they don't yet. But they can sure reach Israel and have already proved it. So those people are living with that kind of fear and concern. But we should not be afraid for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at your side, and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee. Only with your eye shall you behold and see the reward of the wicked. God is going to allow man to bring about the punishments that are listed in the biblical prophecies. Not all of them are as a result of divine intervention. Not all of them are a great angel that comes down and makes the waters bitter. Not all of them are a great meteor that God sends from heaven. Not all of them are a plague where the men, as it says, that are going to fight against Jesus Christ are going to have the flesh melt right off of their bones, and the eyeballs disintegrate in their heads, like while they stand there, because that's the way Christ is going to slay them. With the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. But not all of these are divine fiat and sent as plagues from God. Many of them are man-made. They're the result of warfare. Because you have made the eternal, which is my refuge, even the Most High, thy habitation, there shall no evil befall thee, neither shall any plague come nigh thy dwelling. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. And this is the scripture that Satan the devil perverted and twisted and tried to tempt Jesus Christ with, if you'll remember, to get him to throw himself down from the parapet of the temple. They shall bear thee up in their hands, lest you dash your foot against a stone. You shall tread upon the lion and the adder, or as it says, the asp, a poisonous snake. The young lion and the dragon shall you trample under feet. Because he has set his love upon me, therefore will I deliver him. I will set him on high, God says, because he has known my name. He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation. Let's turn to the 12th chapter of the book of Romans right quickly. Romans, the 12th chapter. This is a very encouraging scripture. The Apostle Paul says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. Sacrifices are over. We don't offer animal sacrifices. But Jesus Christ is our sacrifice, and he went willingly, the most perfect human being who ever walked the earth. If you can imagine a man whose very thoughts were in complete control, and yet he was a man that had to struggle every single day, that had to pray so hard, it said that he was heard with strong cryings and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard that in that he feared. So Jesus Christ had to pray and pray and pray and pray, and sometimes pray for hours without ceasing, prayed so hard that the perspiration was dripping off of his brow, got up in the wee hours of the morning and prayed to God over and over and over again. And as a result, of course, lived an absolutely perfect life and presented himself a sacrifice for our sins and transgressions. We now then owe God as our reasonable debt our lives. Our lives are forfeit. They are not ours, but they are his. And so we say to him figuratively, you take me, take my life, I hereby give myself to you. And I am yours, and I don't belong to me anymore. I am not in control of everything that I say and do anymore. You are in control. You own me, you have purchased me, you have bought me, I am your purchased possession, and I give myself as a living sacrifice. And the way we sacrifice while we're alive is in prayer, is in phone calls and letters to brethren that need help, is in visits to those that are sick and in prison. We sacrifice our time. We sacrifice the things that we want to do, and instead we do the things that we ought to do. And sometimes it is so irksome and it gets to us that we wish we didn't have to do it. But when you force yourself to do it, and you've gone down there to the hospital, or you've gone to that prison, or you've taken the time for that hour and 2 hour phone call, when you're through with it, you feel very, very good. Because you know you've sacrificed some of yourself for your brethren. A living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And finally, I want to turn to the 18th chapter of the book of Revelation. And this is the message that God is sending and should be sending to all the world and to all the people that can hear. This is a warning from a great angelic messenger that came down saying, Babylon the Great is fallen. All nations have been made drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, talking about the great false church. And the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. And verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. I would have a message for those people who decided to go to the nightclub night before last in Israel and make light of an anthrax attack and decorate their club with a scud and take their gas masks and act out falling to the floor. I think they would have been a whole lot better off if they'd simply gotten their knees and called out to God and had a prayer meeting and read about the restoration of Josiah when they discovered the law in the ruins of the temple and decided to turn to God with their whole heart and keep the Passover that year. It would be a lot more sensible to me than having a death kind of a party of making fun of a macabre, agonizing way to die in the threat of the potential of the annihilation of hundreds of thousands of Israelis. Do you know that these are the days in which we live, and I believe they're the days of the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And we have a job to do, a work to do, to get the witness and the warning out there to the people of this nation.